Good evening. It is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, Isabella Garrido, Jaya Kumar, and Abyaz Karim. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. At their April 15th meeting, Council unanimously voted to explore creative social investment options to tackle the housing and homelessness crisis. According to data from the City of Kingston, as of January 2025, 503 individuals are experiencing homelessness in the Kingston community and more are precariously housed. The city currently has a goal of creating 480 affordable housing and supportive housing units by the end of 2026. With an eye towards sustainable development and greater civic engagement, the city is exploring the use of community bonds as a tool to fund affordable housing initiatives. The motion states it is looking to encourage residents and local organizations to invest directly in community projects, while ensuring that the financial benefits, such as interest payments, remain within the community. The city's chief financial officer, Desiree Kennedy, explained what this could look like for the city before council.
The community bonds, so they are a type of social bond, and they are used generally to, the focus of them is generally to have a return that's more around social or environmental impact, so some sort of a positive social impact. They are a community bond in that they do focus on community engagement as opposed to, say, a municipality just going and issuing a bond and doing something. This is about the community being engaged and coming up with solutions, one of which would be a community bond. The other thing is that they tend to be smaller values so that public can participate and be part of what the solution is. They have been used, there's actually a couple of housing examples within Ontario where they've been used. They generally are issued by a not-for-profit or a charity organization, not always by a municipality, though I know the City of Toronto does issue social bonds for various things, but they tend to be more issued through a community. I'm not as familiar, and I think part of this research will be the process around it and how that works, what the interest rate might look like, and potentially it could be a little bit of a lower interest rate if investors are willing to give up some rate in terms of seeing that the impact happening from the bond.
Community bond utilization can be found throughout the province. Examples including Toronto's Social Debenture Program, Kensington Market Community Land Trust, and Haliburton County's Places for People. Kennedy also noted that the city will most likely not incur extra administrative costs.
I think that's part of the research that we will do. I don't see it. I think potentially it would be another entity that would be working to issue those bonds. There is actually a company in Toronto that helps to assist smaller entities with respect to issuing these types of bonds as well. And that's part of the research we will do, is to reach out and have a conversation with them. But certainly, sort of at first glance, without doing more research, I really don't see it as being something that would be a cost administrative to the city.
Councillor Connie Glenn, who sits on the Housing and Homelessness Advisory Committee, motivated the motion, a task that has been in the works for quite some time, according to Councillor Jeff McLaren.
I just want to bring attention to the fact that you were leading this community bond thing through the Housing and Homelessness Advisory Committee. It's something that we've been trying to do for almost two terms now, and you got it done. So thank you very much for your leadership on this.
Staff will provide the Housing and Homelessness Committee and Council with an information report by the third quarter of 2025 with best practices for social investment options. At their last meeting, Council received an update on the Integrated Care Hub and approved $500,000 to keep their shelter services up and running. The Integrated Care Hub is located at 661 Montreal Street, supported by a group of organizations: Addiction and Mental Health Services, Kingston Frontenac Lennox and Addington, Kingston Community Health Centers, Providence Care, Trellis HIV and Community Care, and Homebase Housing. The ICH provides low-barrier services to individuals in need, including a place to rest, meals, and harm reduction supplies. After the September 2024 incident, where two people were killed in the area surrounding the hub and the nearby Bell Park encampment, Councillor Gregory Ridge proposed the ICH present a security and safety plan and form a community consultation group to continue receiving funding from the city.
In addition to these conditions, which were met by the ICH, the motion asked city staff to compile a report with information and safety metrics related to the operation of the Integrated Care Hub. This report was presented to council at their April 15th meeting. Councillor Ridge noted the steep increase in emergency services since the establishment of the ICH in a question to the city's Commissioner of Community Services, Jennifer Campbell.
So I want to start by saying, you know, based on the data tables and the reports that are contained therein, there's a lot to parse there. But I'm going to start with, based on the data that's presented in the report and any data that may be available to staff with regards to increases in emergency response throughout the city, are there any other areas of the city that have a 176% increase in fire response, a 313% increase in paramedic response, or a 372% increase in police response from 2020 to 2021?
Commissioner Campbell, go ahead.
Thank you, and through you. There is not.
However, Ridge also noted the important care the ICH has provided to the community's most vulnerable residents, including their crucial food program.
But I do also want to highlight from the report, there were over 38,000 meals served in 2020. There were over 39,000 served in 2021, just shy of that. So, I think that this is a step in the right direction.
588 unique individuals accessed ICH services from April 1st, 2024 to January 31st, 2025. The report also included a recommendation from a 2022 third-party review of the ICH that select services should be spread out across Kingston. Councillor Tozo underscored what control the city has in terms of ushering in suggested changes.
One of the recommendations was that some of these services put together can cause some exaggerated challenges for the area. And some of the recommendations are separating some of these services out, if I'm reading the report correctly. The other challenge I'm just trying to figure out is we don't control all these services. It's a consortium of partners. I just want to get this on the public record. The city is one small player in a much larger consortium of agencies that are there, and this is provincially funded for the major services.
The conversation around the horseshoe is short, but the community consultation group, which includes neighbors, business owners, community service providers, ICH service providers, and councillors, plans to discuss the new information in more detail, according to Councillor Gregory Ridge. Council unanimously approved the allocation of $500,000 specifically to support shelter operations at the Integrated Care Hub until March 31, 2026. The ICH provided 619 overnight stays in their rest zone in January 2025 alone. This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Hello folks, I'm Abhyas from CFRC News and you are listening to our segment Campus Corner. Here we bring you the latest updates from Queen's Campus. When you hear the word supercomputer, you might picture a giant machine in a secret lab, but they're already changing our everyday lives. This evening on Campus Corner, we are joined by Dr. Ryan Grant, assistant professor at Queen's University and a global expert in high-performance computing. From climate predictions to artificial intelligence, we will unpack what supercomputing really is, why it matters, and how Canada and Queen's fit into the global picture. Hello, Dr. Grant. Thank you for joining us in our studio this evening. How are you doing this evening?
Good, thanks. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for asking. So let's start with the basics. When people hear the word supercomputer, they might picture a massive machine crunching numbers in some high-tech lab. But what exactly is supercomputing? And why does it matter for everyday people?
It's a great question. So supercomputing is the fundamental idea that you can take existing smaller computers and use them together to do something collaboratively. So supercomputers themselves are referred to as capability machines. Mm-hmm. The idea here is that by hooking many different computers together with special networks and special equipment, that we can have multiple computers work on the same problem to solve them far faster than an individual computer could do it. Now, there are other supercomputers in spaces that one would consider super. They're very, very large, to do things like serve your Google search to you and things like that. Those are what we call capacity systems. They work on a whole bunch of different independent tasks that are all fairly small and not interrelated. What we're talking about with capability systems, though, is making many different computers work on one big, gigantic task. So an example of these things include modeling the entire world's climate over many years, doing your weather prediction in time for the weather for the next day, doing training for large language models like ChatGPTs of the world, solving solutions for understanding if there's going to be a tsunami warning after there's an earthquake out in the water. Supercomputers provide us new capabilities because we're able to process problems that are either too large for an individual computer to do or that don't complete in time. So let's give an example of this. What does this really mean? A supercomputer, one of the top supercomputers in the world, can do in a day what it would take your high-powered, good quality laptop about 7 years to do.
Wow.
That's if the problem would actually fit on your laptop. It would never actually fit on your laptop because it's way too big. It would never fit in the memory that's in your laptop. But it gives you an idea of the supercomputing power in that space. And we get there by hooking together tens of thousands of commercial-grade servers all at the same time with very special supercomputing networks.
Right. Great. So I did some research about the G7 countries and where Canada stands. So I see that Canada is falling behind the global supercomputing race, ranking below the other G7 nations. What's holding us back? And what would it take for us to compete with other world leaders like the US and China?
So Canada, because we are a smaller populace, will probably never have the aggregate computing power of China or the US. It would simply cost us too much per capita to do that. But we can, if you want to look at it in this way, the US and China will build multiple very large supercomputers. It's possible in Canada to build over time to building very large supercomputers as well. And we probably only need one of them. We don't need six of them like the US would, right? And that really puts us in contention on a per capita compute basis with everybody else in the world. Now, there's been some recent investments from the federal government in refreshing our existing research infrastructure for computing that's going to improve our numbers a little bit. And there's a much larger investment going on right now in AI infrastructure program from the federal government that's trying to inject enough money into the ecosystem such that we can get into the stratosphere of very large supercomputers in the world, top 10, top 20 type range of supercomputers. What's really held us back in the past is that we don't build big supercomputers. So building big supercomputers is hard, and you need a lot of very specialized talent to be able to do it.
Right.
I learned how to do it in the United States alongside many other colleagues. And for most of the big supercomputers that we were involved with that have used portions of our technology, we worked for many years with industry, vendors, other members of the government, and academia to actually develop new technologies. So if you see a new top three supercomputer come out, you probably are seeing some sort of new first of its kind technology deployment or something that was new and invented specifically for that system. And a significant amount of time and effort and money went into all of that development for that supercomputer. So supercomputers really just push the envelope. It's kind of like an analogy would be, you know, Formula One racing versus your car. Right? Technologies that are used in those really high-end racing competitions can also be eventually used in your car. Regenerative braking came from F1.
Right.
But now it's in your Toyota Prius, right? It's in your electric car that you drive everywhere. And so the same thing happens with high-performance computing. A lot of the technologies that we develop for supercomputers eventually trickle down to business computers or eventually potentially into commercial products that you would buy yourself as well. So we're just sort of the front edge of the technology curve in this space. and we invent the new things that are useful to the rest of the world 10 years from now.
Right. What I have understood is that supercomputers aren't just for scientists in lab coats. They're helping us solve real-world problems, from predicting extreme weather, like the tsunami example you gave, to advancing medical breakthroughs. So what are some of the most exciting ways supercomputers is shaping our future?
That is a very interesting question. So supercomputers touch your lives today. You don't even realize it, right? If you check the weather today, you used a supercomputer. If you chatted to ChatGPT, you used the output of a supercomputer. I think that supercomputers touch our lives when we need them to. So they either provide the ability to develop new green technologies. We saw recent advances with supercomputers and AI, where hundreds of years of equivalence of research was done on new mineral discovery in a matter of months. So at this point, we're starting to do massive amounts of research in a very short period of time. Practical elements to it become personalized medicine. The idea that in the future, you could go into a hospital and that hospital will have supercomputing capabilities. They'll be able to take a look at you and model your entire body in a as a digital twin and understand things like, you know, if you had a early stage cancer and they were worried that it might metastasize and attach somewhere else, we can actually model how all of your blood cells move through your particular veins, figure out where they those cancer cells might get quote-unquote stuck in your circulatory system, so we can figure out where they might metastasize to, so we can monitor other sites in that space. We can do interesting things with understanding what climate change looks like over the long term and what the effects of those are. We can understand very finite detail in terms of earthquake modeling. In the example of earthquake simulation, our previous petascale systems were able to do things like model an earthquake and all of the buildings in the San Francisco Bay Area. And we could shake them all at the same time and we could see which ones were affected and which ones were in danger. But we were only capable of modeling the ground as ground. It was all dirt. It wasn't different layers of dirt. It was dirt, right? As a basic property. We didn't do layers of clay and layers of water and gravel and everything else.
Okay.
We moved to the exascale era. We were capable of modeling those different layers. This is work that other people did, of course. I'm not the applications earthquake person, but we were able to model the different layers on these larger systems so that we could understand how soils interacted with each other. We actually found out in that case that unlike the petascale era where we thought very tall buildings were the number one building that was in danger, different areas of that Bay Area that were have median-sized buildings, not high-rises, but a reasonable number of stories, five or six stories, were actually even more in danger. It was partially due to the soil mixes they had underneath them that were worried about liquefacting when they shake. So you get new capabilities as you go from era to era to do things more and more in depth and more of them at the same time. I mean, the AI revolution that we have now today, LLMs, is not just smart people coming up with new ways to do things. It's also enabled by just sheer compute, right? You basically just take the internet and feed the entire internet into a language model and you get something useful at the other end. That's an awful lot of data and right. You need to be able to process those things. And that's really what supercomputing is getting us to in the future, is more and more capability to do more and more complex things and make the things that we could do in the previous eras inexpensive enough that we can start making them more broadly available to people to impact their lives.
Wonderful. Let's talk about Queen's. So at Queen's, how are students and researchers getting their hands on experience with supercomputers? And what role does the university play in introducing these young minds to the high-tech fields?
So that is an excellent question. So here at Queen's, we have access to several supercomputers throughout the national ecosystem here in Canada. We also have, through depending on the professor's lab, some relationships worldwide, through the US, Japan, Europe primarily, with collaborative agreements with them to be able to use this, some of their supercomputing capabilities as well. We collaborate with researchers that do supercomputing work, as well as all the sciences that need supercomputers to actually discover new things. So we've been training students in areas of things like molecular dynamics, materials, My particular lab teaches students how to build supercomputers, the architectures behind them. We improve the software that makes them work. We improve the networking stacks that make them able to be supercomputers in the first place. We develop new standards. Those standards get deployed worldwide, partially based on our work and partially based on the work of others, which we combine together into standards to make computers communicate better. And I also work a lot on leading a global effort of power monitoring and control on large supercomputers so we can make them operate in the most energy efficient ways possible. And that leads to either greater efficiency, so we're using electrons in better ways and we're doing more with them, and also the opportunities to be able to sort of turn things down and lessen our impact on the environment as well in that space. And sometimes you'll find that you actually do both of those things at the same time, that making things go much faster actually makes the overall impact of the system to be able to do a particular job much more green, because we've been able to do it that much more effectively.
Right. Amazing. This actually brings us to the very end of our segment. Thank you, Dr. Grant. Thanks for being with us in studio tonight. But we have a lot more to talk about supercomputers. So as you have promised, you'll be with us in the next two episodes as well. We are eagerly looking forward to that. And that's a wrap, folks. I am Abhyas from CFRC News, and you are listening to our segment, Campus Corner. Stay tuned for more updates. Over to Isabella for sports after.
This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Wednesday, April 23rd, looking like a beautiful day here in the city of Kingston. Daytime high of 14, and it will be sunny and clear, dropping down to 5 overnight. Thursday, April 24th, we are going to see temperatures into the mid-teens with a daytime high of 15 degrees and a 30% chance of showers throughout the day, dropping down to 9 overnight. Friday, April 25th, it'll be cloudy but dry with a daytime high of 15 degrees, dropping down to 8 overnight with a 60% chance of precipitation. Saturday, April 26th, a little cooler, a little more rainy, high of 12 with a 40% chance of showers, dropping down to about 6 degrees overnight. Moving into Sunday, April 27th, we're going to have a beautiful day here in the city of Kingston. Daytime high of 14, and it will be sunny. And then starting the next week, Monday, April 28th, it'll be 14 and cloudy. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. The heavy load restrictions are in effect in Kingston until April 22nd. Until then, heavy trucks and loads are restricted on city roads where posted. These restrictions help reduce damage to roads in the spring. A complete list of roads with restrictions can be found on the Traffic Bylaw section of the City of Kingston website. Public Services and Procurement Canada wishes to advise the public that the LaSalle Causeway will be fully closed to vehicles, cyclists, and pedestrians on the following dates. Saturday, May 3rd from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m., Saturday, May 17th from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m., and Saturday, May 31st from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. During these periods, the removal of the modular bridge will begin at 6 a.m., with the marine channel expected to be open by 9 a.m. The marine channel will be closed at 5 p.m. to reinstall the bridge. The causeway is expected to reopen to vehicles, cyclists, and pedestrians by 8 p.m. Here are some road closures to be aware of. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Demare Street, Taylor Kidd to Wheat Hill is closed from April 22nd to May 2nd for servicing works. Russell Street, Patrick to Kent is closed April 23rd and 24th from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. for sanitary sewer line repairs. Victoria Street, Union Street to Johnson Street is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Here are some other relevant delays. Accommodation Road, expect delays while a contractor completes landscaping work around the newly installed culvert at the north end of Accommodation Road. Bay Ridge Drive, Milford to Henderson, expect delays for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure and intersection upgrades. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Gardner's Road at Centennial and Creekford. Expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence. Expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Montreal Street at John Counter. Expect delays for upgrades to the intersection including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving and signage to improve safety and efficiency, and to accommodate increased traffic from the Wabin Crossing. Victoria Street and Earl Street. Expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction for sewer, water main, sidewalks, and road.
Hello everyone, my name is Henry, CFRC intern from the Department of History. We're going through this week's concerts and events calendars. On Wednesday, Whiskey Smoke will be playing a gig at the Buckle starting at 7:30. Hotel Wolf Island will also be running its usual open mic night from 8:30 to 11:30. Also on Wednesday, the Kingston Grand, as part of their Grand On Stage series, will have performers of the Classic Albums Live Concert Series playing the Fleetwood Mac album Rumours. This performance starts at 7:30 p.m. with tickets available on the Grand's website for around between $44 and $55. Frank Ryan is also scheduled to play Wednesday night between 8 and 11 at Musiki. On Thursday, Trailer Swift Band will be playing at the Buckle from 8 to 11 p.m. The Ukulele Orchestra of Great Britain is scheduled to perform at the Isabel Bader at 7:30 Thursday evening. Tickets for said performance are available for between $15 and $35 on the Isabel's website. Also on Thursday, three bands, B.A. Johnston, Owl Farm, and The Strange Happenings will be playing at the Mansion. Tickets for the show, starting at 9 p.m., are available for around $10 on Ticketscene or for $15 at the door. The Toucan also has some live performers lined up for Thursday night with Sarah Jane Riley and Dylan Ireland performing from 9:10 to 1 as part of their Rules for the Collective Good tour. After that, on Friday, band Cheyenne Twink will be playing a concert at the Broom Factory. The show, starting at 7:30, has tickets available on Ticketscene for around $25. Also on Friday, the blues/rock group Hellhound Trail will be playing at the RCHA starting at 8 p.m. On Saturday, Frank Ryan is on to play a set or two at Tiernanog from 7 to 9. The Boo Radley Project will also be returning to the Toucan Saturday night for a show running from 10:30 to 2. Also Saturday night, the Marion Drexler Band will be playing at the RCHA starting at 8. On Sunday, Neil Carter will be performing a collection of classics at Spearhead Brewery from 2 to 5, and later on, Savannah Shea will be playing at Musiki from 4:30 to 6:30. Have a concert you would like to add to our online and on-air concert calendar? Reach out today via cfrc.ca or at cfrcmusic on Instagram using the link tree in our bio. Again, I'm Henry, CFRC intern for the Department of History. We're continuing with today's concert and events calendars. On Wednesday, folks can head down to Musiki, which is hosting its weekly life drawing event. Don't forget to bring your own art supplies and $5 and participate in uninstructed life drawing. Also on Wednesday, One Eye Jats will be hosting Board Game Night starting at 7, and both Something in the Water and Daft Brewing will be hosting their trivia nights, both starting at 7 p.m. On Thursday, Daft will host Queerioki from 8 to 11. Folks can also head to the Kingston Public Market, which is open from 8:30 to 4 p.m. in Springer Market Square. The Kingston Spring Night Market will also be running at Memorial Center from 4 to 8 p.m. Also on Thursday, the Out in Front Weekly Run Group will be hosting its usual public run this Thursday, starting downtown at 6:15 p.m. in front of Runner's Choice. All people are invited regardless of ability, sex, sexual orientation, or gender identity. On Friday, the Buckle and Daft Brewing will both be hosting their weekly free karaoke nights. Doors open at 9. On Saturday, Queen's PhD students will be giving a free talk in Ellis Hall at 7:30 p.m. The talk is open to the public, free, and will be followed by a tour of the Queen's Observatory. Folks can also head down to participate in Runner's Choice East End Run Group at 7:50 a.m. at the Canets Kingston Supermart, 29 Niagara Park. The Kingston Public Market also runs from 8:30 to 4 p.m. at Springer Market Square. On Sunday, the Runner's Choice Lawn Run starts downtown outside their store at 8:20 a.m. All ages and paces are welcome. And finally, the Memorial Center Farmers Market will take place from 9 to 1 p.m. at Memorial Center. Do you have a concert or event you would like to add to our online or on-air concerts and events calendars? Reach out today via cfrc.ca or at cfrcmusic on Instagram using the link tree in our bio. I have been Henry, CFRC intern for the Queen's Department of History, and this has been my last broadcast of the concert and events calendars updates. Someone else will be taking over soon. I hope everyone listening has a nice summer. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.